generation. God gives strength in loving arms, scatters the proud of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm Katherine Young.
There's a widespread misconception that faith is not interested in fact and scientific research. It's simply a misconception, because faith is always concerned about reality and truth. For faith to be active, faith has to know what the facts are. And today, we're talking about the realities of Black Americans' access to health care. Faith and science are friends, not enemies. Science measures and explores the natural world that God created. God created the world in such a way that science works, because God made the world accessible. And October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in women. Only lung cancer kills more women each year. And in recent years, incidence rates have increased slightly, 0.3% per year. About 276,480 new cases of invasive breast cancer will be diagnosed in women this year. About 42,170 women will die. Black women in all age groups are significantly more likely than white women to be diagnosed at a more advanced stage and to have larger tumors, higher grade tumors, and positive lymph nodes. This is an alarming reality, and we're here to talk about this disparity and what is being done to eliminate these structural inequalities.
So we're happy, honored, and elated to have with us Dr. Kristen Black. Welcome to our Faith and Reason 360 podcast.
Dr. Black.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Black is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Education and Promotion at East Carolina University. She received her Master's of Public Health in 2011 and her PhD in 2016 in maternal and child health from the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Dr. Black's career commitment is to utilize community-based participatory research, mixed methods, and racial equality approaches to understand and address inequalities in chronic disease and reproductive health outcomes. Additionally, she is a member of the Greensboro Health Disparity Collaborative, a board member of the Sisters Network, Greensboro, North Carolina, and a board member of the Society for the Analysis of African-American Public Health Issues. She lives in Greenville, North Carolina, with her spouse, Mensa, two-year-old beautiful daughter, Zora, and her seven-year-old pit bull cattle dog, Jada.
Oh, again, welcome, Dr. Black.
Thank you so much.
Well, with these credentials, I'm a little bit intimidated, but we're going to move on with our first question.
You shouldn't be intimidated at all. They're just degrees in education.
Oh, well, actually, before we get started, tell me about Jada.
Me and my husband adopted her first year we were married. We've been together for 14 plus years, but got married 5 years, oh, a little over 5 years ago, and decided we wanted to add to our family, start off with a dog and see if we could take care of it. And it went really well. Like, she's so well-behaved. She can sit in our yard on the front porch, and all of our neighbors talk about how well-behaved she is. Like, she doesn't leave the porch. She hangs out there. She's really loving. Her and my daughter are, like, best friends. So it's really nice to have her. Like, she's my four-legged daughter. That's what we call her.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask, how does Zora get along with Jada? So I guess they get along pretty well.
Yeah, they do. Well, I think Zora likes Jada more than Jada likes Zora. They're still getting she's getting used to a toddler being able to pull at her and try to climb her and things like that. But I think that Jada loves having the extra affection and attention. So it works in both of their favors.
That's adorable. Well, I'm going to start off with a question. And I know you've done a lot of research. And so every now and then I might have to interrupt and say, I'm not sure I'm following that. So if we could just put it down just a little bit into a little less complicated language, I might end up doing that, if that's okay.
No, that's perfect.
Well, Dr. Black, for many years, you've been extensively involved in research that addresses the inequality in our healthcare system that tragically impacts Black and brown women. Compared with whites, women of racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to receive preventative health services and often receive lower quality care. What is some of the work being done to identify implicit bias and structural racism in the health system?
Well, I'm going to speak to you from the perspective of one of the studies that I have been involved in. And one thing that we were doing was that we were analyzing the policies, protocols, and also the culture of a specific health system so that we can provide us more insight into the ingrained inequities that we're incurring in those systems. And this is one approach that a lot of people who were working on structural racism and systems tend to do. But one important way that we can actually do this is to start off by analyzing patient outcomes by race when we're talking about the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And so many health systems don't analyze patient outcomes by race in real time. Oftentimes, these data are analyzed many months after the data are entered. So in the Accountability for Cancer Care through Undoing Racism and Equity study that I was involved in as a graduate student and also a postdoc, our community medical academic partnership, which is called the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative, we actually monitored breast and lung cancer patients' treatment outcomes in real time so that we could take action immediately and ensure that each patient's care was being delivered in a timely fashion and that it also had a greater chance of being completed. And so what we saw was that if you look at a system, look for the inequities that are occurring, and you make changes to the policies and procedures that are happening, so some of these structural and systemic issues, that you actually can see change and improvements in patients' outcomes. And that's one thing that we learned from that study.
So you say that many don't analyze these differences, and maybe that information is loaded months afterwards, so the patients aren't actually followed. So what happens? Why is it that why don't other hospitals, you know, monitor their patients like this?
Well, the one thing is like having the resources to do it, and we and also having the kind of health systems to do that. So with the electronic health records now that have been mandated for all hospitals and clinical systems to use, that they have certain things that they do well, which is be able to load in data quickly right there in the moment for the patient. But you have to have somebody on the end, a data scientist or a statistician or someone else who knows how to take that data and analyze it. One thing that we did with the ACURE study is that we added this real-time registry that was connected to the electronic health records so that we can actually, that data was being imported nightly to the real-time registry, all the patients we were following, and somebody else at the other end who was a nurse navigator was following that data. So if a patient missed a treatment milestone or they didn't make an appointment, an alert would go to the nurse navigator and they would actually see that something was occurring and then contact that patient or their provider to make sure that that patient got into treatment or their appointments were rescheduled. So this is a part of the system that's not naturally in healthcare systems right now, to have this kind of feedback loop of data and actually looking at data by race. And we've really been trying to promote our project and what we've been doing to show that adding this component works. But it costs money. Mm-hmm. Two, it needs extra resources and knowledgeable people about data, but then also having these resources from the provider in by having like a nurse or someone else who's monitoring the data. So there's a lot of pieces that need to happen.
You know, you've clarified something for me that I absolutely had no idea about. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer, now it's been almost 6 years in November, one of the very first individuals that I spoke with, other than my doctors, was a nurse navigator. And I really didn't understand what her role was. And I still visit the Center for Breast Health and take them cookies during Breast Cancer Month. And take them a king cake during Mardi Gras. But I had I had no idea that her role was so vital to my health and recovery. So thank you. Yeah,
No, but I feel like that's like a misstep in the process in terms of being able to make sure that patients are connected to these nurse navigators. And oftentimes, the nurse navigators serve in roles that they are really trying to guide patients through a very complex system. So if you're not in a medical care system and you're not in it often, it can be very hard to navigate to know like where to go and who to call and what to do at every moment. So the nurse navigators are there, one, to typically make sure that you're going to appointments and that you have somebody to ask questions to directly, but then also, two, to make sure that you're any other needs that you have that may be impacting your ability to seek care, such as transportation or financial issues or anything like that, that they should be able to connect you with those things. So it just depends on the hospital setting and how they've set up their navigation system. Sometimes that person is a nurse. Sometimes that person is a community member. It could be a peer. There's all kinds of models for patient navigation. But all of them are supposed to be like a key cornerstone in helping people get through these very, very complex systems.
And I think that's one of the things that, especially in rural, remote counties, there is a lack of, you find very few nurse navigators that are there in those communities that are highly populated with African Americans, where we see what the disparities are and the lack of the quality care. And you find that women actually in those counties are dying at much alarming rate than in larger cities and you know, bigger counties. And for them, you know, to have someone that they can actually go to and ask those hard questions, because oftentimes it is, you know, being in contact or sitting next to a medical professional sometimes can be intimidating. But if you have that nurse navigator to fill in the gap, who you feel comfortable with going to asking those hard questions and having them to sit down and explain with you, it makes all the difference in outcome of a woman's care.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Yeah, I was more fortunate than I had any idea.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, you know, white Americans are much more fortunate than some of, you know, black people are in where they are and where they get their care from. But our next question, for decades throughout our country's history, the hallmark of American democracy, opportunity, prestige, power, good health, freedom, and prosperity have been largely reserved for white people through the intentional inclusion and oppression of people of color. The deep racial and ethnic inequalities that exist today are a direct result of structural racism. The historical and contemporary policies, practices, and norms that create and maintain white supremacy. People of color are dying disproportionately. Our education system for brown children are suffering. Children of color aren't getting the nutrition they need. Expectant mothers are having preterm births. Children with low birth weight. The list goes on and on. In 1906, you stated W.E.D. Du Bois noted that social conditions, not genetics, impacted the health of blacks, causing racial disparities and mortality rate. In 2010, the federal government formally recognized that social conditions, specifically the social determinants of health, were responsible for racial health disparity. Does your research show any advancements or improvements to addressing this critical issue?
So, thank you for that. That was a great introduction to that question. And I really turn to the Kaiser Family Foundation's model of social determinants of health, and it lists six core buckets of determinants, which are economic stability, neighborhood and physical environment, education, food, communities, and social context, as well as healthcare system. And so most of my work has been centered around community and social context, as well as the healthcare system. And the core of my work really involves using community-based participatory research approaches. So I believe that many of the inequities we see in all of the systems in the U.S. can be more effectively addressed if community members, nonprofits, stakeholders, policymakers, government agencies, academics, and others, you can name several people in the community, if we all work collaboratively to design and implement programs and policies, that we can really see true change. And to really answer your question directly, I think that the ACURE study that I mentioned earlier, and it was led by Dr. Jeannie Ng and Samuel Seichert, they did this in partnership with the collaborative, is an excellent example of how health inequities can be eliminated through CBPR approaches. So through training nurse navigators and anti-racism approaches to care, monitoring patients' treatment milestones by race, as I mentioned, and also educating health system providers and staff and administrators about the health inequities that are occurring in their specific systems. The CURE study, it not only increased treatment completion for Black and white breast and lung cancer patients at two cancer centers, it also eliminated the previous Black-white gap in treatment completion. So we see that addressing determinants of health and using CBPR approaches, not only does it help patients of color, but it helps white patients too. So the thing is that these systems is that when they are not operating at their optimal level, then that really impacts everyone in the system. And when we begin to see that just by doing these changes, that we're not only helping marginalized populations, but everyone, I think everyone, more people would have an investment in trying to make sure that these systems are operating at the highest level.
You know, Dr. Black, are you finding that the medical professionals are being receptive to the research that you are doing? Do you find that once you have this information available and you present this information to these medical professionals, that they are receptive and that they, you know, change possibly how they're responding to women of color in their treatment?
It all depends. At first, it's sometimes hard to win over providers about health inequities because in the practice of medicine, the whole idea is to do no harm and that we're naturally treating everyone equal. A patient is a patient. But what we see in the data is that that's not what's happening. And we're seeing that Black, Indigenous, and other people of color are having worse outcomes when they're coming out of these health systems and less trust in these systems. And so something's happening. And so what we have found to be useful is like really showing these providers their data. So taking the data from their hospital system and showing them that, yes, you may treat all your patients equally, but here's what your data is saying about their outcomes. And so you can't really argue against that.
Right.
Other times at other kind of audiences, we use some of the qualitative data that we use. So we've done focus groups with breast and lung cancer patients and asked them about what are their perceived kind of barriers and challenges, but also kind of the windows of opportunity throughout their cancer journey. And so sharing that data on top of the quantitative data and the numbers, like the numbers went over the providers, and then the contextual issues and stories kind of went over other audiences like administration and staff. So we really have to kind of build the case that this is an issue in their system. And then people tend to be more kind of willing to proactively participate in discussions about how can we fix these things? Like, how can we change what's happening so that we have better outcomes? So I think that's worked really well for myself and my community partners that I've been working with for the past few years.
Well, it's obviously very important work, because I would think that even some of the professionals are doing this not even out of their awareness.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, implicit bias is subconscious. Like, yes, you're acting on biases that you don't even know you're doing. So, right, of course, people are not aware, fully aware of what their individual actions, how that's impacting patient outcomes. Wow. Like, that makes sense.
Wow. It makes perfect sense to me.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that your current research focuses on addressing the sexual and reproductive health needs of breast cancer survivors. So what has your research revealed regarding structural inequalities that impact cancer care for Black and brown women?
So I conducted a mixed method study, and it was called Birth Outcomes and Reproductive Needs of Young Breast Cancer Survivors, and I call it the Born Study. And I first examined the birth outcomes of the general reproductive aid population and compared them to breast cancer survivors in North Carolina, and this data reached from 1990 all the way to 2009, so about 20 years of data. So in that study, my colleagues and I, we actually found that women with a breast cancer history had a 30 to 67% increase in risk of delivering a preterm baby, a low birth weight infant, or a small for gestational age infant. And that was compared to the general population. The women who had a breast cancer history and then also received chemotherapy or gave birth within 2 years had an even greater risk of these poor birth outcomes. So this led me to interview young breast cancer survivors ages 45 and younger to really learn more about their sexual reproductive health needs around the time they were diagnosed with breast cancer. So from these 17, these were very dynamic and courageous women. I learned that they were really receiving limited information about their reproductive health needs and its relationship to their cancer treatment, and the women who wanted to have children after completing treatment, because not all of them did, they wanted more positive support to reach their ideal family size. They felt that either their cancer providers or their other primary care physicians weren't giving them the support they needed to successfully see that through. So ultimately, the cancer care system did not meet the sexual and reproductive needs of these women that led to them dealing with many of these issues on their own and or with the help of alternative sources, which could be like books and support groups and things of that nature. So I feel like this is a missed opportunity for the cancer care system to care for patients holistically and really to help patients deal with the aftermath of cancer diagnosis and treatment. Cancer survivorship is a hot topic in the health field, but there have been many struggles really trying to find effective ways to adequately provide care for cancer survivors who may have physical and mental health issues after they complete treatment. So in my Born study, when I interviewed the actual young breast cancer survivors, we found that women of color were more likely to experience body image disturbance. We also had another important but not surprising finding where only the white women in my study reported participating in clinical trials. So this is an oh too familiar story where there's not enough people of color being recruited into these trials, also that trust the healthcare system enough to participate. And so we end up not knowing enough about these new treatments and how they may influence communities of color differently. So there's a lot of issues along the way that are structural issues and barriers for young women, women of color, and white women to actually navigate the system and be able to get the care that they need or the support mm-hmm. they need to be reproductively and sexually well after their treatment and even during their treatment.
I'm sorry, Dr. Fike. Are these patients, these young women, are they given information about the potential to be sterile after certain treatments? And then what are their options? And is that presented to them?
Yeah, well, what tends to happen is that the breast cancer survivors, and you guys may be able to attest to this more than I can, is they're often bombarded with a lot of information about a lot of different things that relates to their treatment and their care and their diagnosis. And so every person is supposed to receive information about how their course of treatment may impact their care. But if that's not directly spoken to them and they're not talked about or they're not told directly about those things and it's just thrown into a binder with a whole bunch of other information, that might be easily overlooked because the focus is trying to get rid of the cancer, and as it should be for breast cancer. But the thing is, the treatments are doing so well that a lot of these women are living long lives after cancer. So we need to think about what are some of the potential impacts of that treatment that are going to have some of these short and long-term effects on them. So I think that patients are not always getting that information. There have been a lot of movements and interventions happening to try to figure out how can they better educate providers or better educate patients about reproductive health during the cancer treatment. But the thing is that they need to make sure that they have as much information as possible so that they can make decisions about their care, if they want to freeze their eggs or do other things like suppressing their ovaries prior to treatment to kind of help them have the ability to have a natural birth after they're finished with treatment. So they're trying to make that a reality for them.
I think it's the explicit bias that we see, that especially with women of color, that especially if they have children or one or two children, you see, historically how, women of color were treated and didn't want to have, and the physicians didn't want them to have more children. So some of that explicit bias continues today, where they figure that if a woman already has children, why give her any more information about her reproductive health, to try to keep that suppressive from her having more children. And whereas you see other whites, they are supposed to have, more children. So the information is readily given and available to them. And, that's why you see during our focus group, when we did focus group for our community profile, we found a lot of young women, talk about the mistrust of the healthcare system and not participating in the clinical trials for some of these various reasons because of the injustice that was done prior to and the repetitive, motion of some of the same things happening today. And this is just one of the examples of things that continue to happen today. It's not, as prevalent, but it still exists. And I think physicians don't take enough time to sit down with their African-American patients and give them all of this information and let them make an informed decision as to what they want to happen with their own body. But they are,
That's just unconscionable. So it makes your research that much more vital.
I appreciate that the reason why I was doing this research is because I was really interested in the experiences of young women who have cancer and other chronic illnesses, which is really the focus of my work now, because there's a lot of things that happen to African-American women, other women of color, where the chronic stress feeds into our bodies over time, and that we are actually being diagnosed with chronic diseases at younger ages, but yet we still want to build families and that we need to have the opportunity to do so. So I'm really interested in how chronic disease management and treatment and diagnosis really impacts these young women who are experiencing these chronic diseases at earlier ages than they should be experiencing them, and how can we better support them. And also just to your point about not listening to black women and not providing them with spaces where they can be able to have children and as many children as they want. Another layer to that I saw in my work when I was doing the interviews with some of these survivors was that the added layer of age as an impact. Because there's also this idea that women of a certain age shouldn't be having children. So once you're in your late 30s and early 40s, your time is out. And so that also played into how some of the patients were getting recommendations about what treatments they should take that were a lot more invasive and that would take away all their possibility of having children, whereas they really had to advocate for themselves to get treatment less invasive treatments, I should say, so that they were able to actually bear children if they decided to after the treatment was done. So there's a lot of kind of multitude of issues that are happening, and I wholeheartedly agree with you that it's still happening, that we're not listening to black women and what they need and what they want, and not providing with the resources and knowledge they need to make informed decisions in their care.
Most definitely. And that is such a wonderful study that you are doing, and I hope that it produces a better understanding for physicians and, let them take a chance to step back and treat all of their patients and give them all the knowledge and information that they need to make an informed decision. A study released by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation noted racial health disparities estimated a cost to the United States of $175 billion in lost life years and $135 billion per year in excessive health care costs. Yet untapped productivity persists because of the failure to address their root cause, which we can say one of them is structural racism. The structural racism describes the way our systems are structured to produce racial inequalities between white, racial, and ethnic minorities in the social determinants of health, leading to racial health disparities. Do you have any examples of some structures we have in place today that are impacting people of color? Because we always make the comment or the case that it costs our healthcare system more money in care after the diagnosis than preventive care if we just did some of the preventive stuff to prevent some of the things that are occurring in our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. You're completely right. And I think this is a very important question. And the reality is that every system is structured to disadvantage Black, Indigenous, and other people of color and low-income communities while advantaging white people and people from high-income communities. And one thing, if we're thinking about the social determinants of health, where one lives plays a huge role in their health outcomes as well as determines many of the other social determinants of health. So, for instance, it is evident that people who live in rural communities, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, they have limited access to care in their communities at times, or they have to travel long distances to receive necessary care. Also, in many communities that are rural, they have challenges with income stability due to the lack of jobs that are in their areas, and this impacts access to health care along with a number of other social determinants of health. Another example is that communities of color are at a higher risk of living near waste sites and industrial plants, which puts them at risk of being exposed to various toxins and also experiencing a range of long-term and short-term health issues. So people of color are also more likely to live in food deserts where they have limited access to healthy and affordable food options. So these systems don't work in silos because the people don't work in silos, that we don't live in silos. We actually interact with all of these systems on a regular basis. So when these systems are not structured to meet the needs of people of color or poor people, then we are being negatively impacted from multiple angles on a daily basis. So these daily encounters with discrimination, racism, structural inequities, they cause chronic stress. And this gets under the skin, and it really leads to us experiencing a range of physical and mental health issues that we shouldn't be experiencing at the ages that occur, particularly in people of color.
I am so glad that you made the point of a food desert as one of the structures that we have in place. We see that food deserts and obesity and diabetes is one of the triggers of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer is one of the things that make them at more higher risk. And when we look at the food deserts that exist across the states and how policies are purposely put in place to allow those fast food chains and you know restaurants that have high calorie carbohydrates, sugar foods that are located, and you find that in the African American community, it is flooded with restaurants and fast food chains that are like that. And one study that I remember reading that this was purposely done and policies was purposely put in place for that particular reason. And is one of the reasons why it is, I think, on the list of the structural racism is because there are, if you look at certain geographic locations, you have less high-calorie food chains. You have more fresh fruits and vegetables. You have access to walking trails, biking trails, and secure housing. And so these are some of the things that, continue to see over and over and over again. And you can pinpoint the African-American communities where these type of things are happening. And we continue to see those things. Mm-hmm. And what can we do about them? What can we advocate to try to ensure that these communities have the same access to those, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, walking trails. And there have been many organizations that have tried to actually put that in place and offer these things, but we still see that disparity that continues to exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very important question that I think a lot of different industries are trying to tackle, not just to the health, but policy leaders and government agencies as well. But I think the problem is that the way that cities are planned in the first place. So one thing, my husband is a civil engineer. One thing he brought to my attention was that these, you know, new structures and new buildings and parks and home, you know, like new homes and things, they plan these things often 10, 20 years in advance. So they're making projections about who's going to live in that area, who's going to want to live in that area. And that really determines people's investment in making those areas better or are not investing in them at all. And we often see that when some of these communities are kind of improved or enhanced in some ways, that it makes it more difficult for people of color and poor people to live in those areas. So gentrification, it has actually made it the situation worse for people of color, not better. So we have to find ways that we're enhancing communities and providing with the services and structures they need in order to be healthy that are going to actually benefit the people that are living there currently and be, allow them to stay in their neighborhoods and continue to invest in their neighborhoods. That's what we really need to see. And so there's initiatives, I feel like, on the like community organizing level that are trying to really think about policies and investments in these communities and what that can look like, the placement of grocery stores, the placement of affordable food locations beyond fast food. All these things are matters that are being worked at from a community organization level. Also, I know public health scholars are really invested in this topic as well, but it has to be coming from different levels. It can't just be coming from public health. It can't just be community organizing. It just can't be policymakers. We all have to work together mm-hmm. to figure out ideas that are going to be helpful for that community. And that's just not happening at a wide scale as it should be, unfortunately. So there needs to be more movement around that.
You know, Dr. Black, we're all of us live in the Deep South, and most of us in the Deep South are heavily involved in our churches and are very committed to our faith. And so many of us are of the Christian tradition, but then we have Jewish, Muslim traditions. And basically they all share the same idea of loving thy neighbor as thyself and a commitment to justice for everyone. And yet what you and Catherine are pointing out are the devastating injustices that exist primarily in the African American community. So I want to just throw this in and ask your response about your experience, particularly with breast cancer. Is the valuable role one's faith has on the health and recovery of the patient in your research? You often talk about the importance of partnerships and community, and we just shared how important it is that we all work together for the betterment of everyone. So has your work addressed religious leaders, particularly African-American pastors, and the key role that they play in addressing health disparities?
So my work thus far has not specifically worked with pastors, but one thing, it always comes out, and particularly when I'm doing interviews with people about the importance of faith and how that's really guiding people in some of their decision making. And so a lot of my colleagues and some of my mentors have collaborated with the church community and faith leaders to figure out how to disseminate programs to the church, the congregations, in a multitude of ways. And there's actually a really long history of current and former scholars at UNC Chapel Hill working with faith communities, including my mentor, Alex Lightfoot, Dr. Alex Lightfoot. There's also Drs. Marcy Campbell, Lori Carter Edwards, Giselle Corby Smith. They've all worked with church communities on a range of health outcomes because we know that churches are the pillars of Black communities, especially in the South. And really one way to improve the health of communities is to get their key leaders on board with a program or even lead the dissemination of health messaging. So it's really imperative that public health researchers work with church communities to develop and implement health-based programs and interventions. And we all know too well that pastors, when they get fired up about a topic, that they have a lot of influence on their congregations and surrounding community support and investment in that issue. And Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, he's a prime example of this in North Carolina. He's actually the pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church, and it's in Goldsboro, mm-hmm. North Carolina. And he's been a prominent social justice and anti-discrimination change agent in North Carolina through his Building a Moral Movement initiative. So he began in 2013 organizing these Moral Mondays, and they were these civil rights protests in Raleigh, which is the capital of North Carolina, the state capital. And these Moral Monday protests actually garnered national attention to some of the injustices that were happening for a lot of different communities, not just the Black community, but LGBTQ rights and poor people and a lot of different groups that are being marginalized in our society. And he's also, but this is like one of many things that he's led in terms of having kind of a social justice edge. So thinking about him and what he's done, is this, I imagine if every state or even every city had a Reverend Barber, what kind of change that could happen in Black communities and other communities of color across this nation. Like, these are true leaders in our communities, and if we can get them on board to really justify and advocate for social justice as they have been for decades and decades, like Reverend Barber has, that we can make a lot of movement towards doing the right thing for our communities.
Yes, in fact, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I don't really know or can't imagine someone in this country not knowing of Reverend Barber and the work that he's doing. And Moral Mondays was just one of the things that helped really launch people's awareness about this need. And mm-hmm. He would be an ideal person to deal with addressing the health disparities and to addressing breast cancer and the mm-hmm. Experiences that these young women, women of all ages, go through. But you're right, the pillar of the community, especially in the Black community, is the church, and that church has such an opportunity to save lives. I mean, people that are diagnosed mm-hmm. with breast cancer are just devastated, and you immediately cling to your faith and you pray to God every moment, waking moment, please let me heal, please just to help me get through this. And how wonderful to be able to be on the other end of that, in other words, prior to getting sick, to know that your faith is there. And there's a health disparity issue that's being immediately addressed.
Yeah, and I think if churches are a perfect avenue for reaching people and educating them about some of these issues so that they could get screened in advance, or if they are diagnosed with breast cancer, they have additional resources to support them. So one organization that I'm involved in as a board member is the Sisters Network Greensboro in North Carolina. And Sisters Network is a national organization that aims to advocate for African American and Black women as it relates to breast cancer, and they really promote breast cancer awareness. And so the chapter that I belong to, we actually will go to churches and present information about breast cancer awareness, like doing self-exams, how to get mammographies for free or low cost, and tell them about the services that Sisters Network actually offers if you do have breast cancer, in terms of helping with some of those needs. And so there's a lot of work that can be done in churches, and that is being done through churches that relates to health and health disparities. And Sisters Network is a great example of doing some of that work.
Yes, that's good news.
On the flip side, sometimes I think, and I have come in contact with people of strong faith, and one of the reasons why I like when you talk about cultural competency, because oftentimes mm-hmm. we see women who use their faith not to get treatment, not to get screenings. And so that's an important aspect for, you know, for us to recognize and understand as well, that our culture and our faith sometimes dictates some of our health outcomes as well. Although we have wonderful pastors that are advocating for certain things, there are still some pastors that teach that, you know, believe and trust in God and everything will be okay. And we are seeing a great number of women who are dying disproportionately because they are behind their faith lies. They're not seeking care, if I'm putting this out there right. And so the cultural competency, when it comes to physicians and nurses, when they encounter and come in contact with these women who use that as a means to say, if, you know, I don't want to know. If I don't know, it won't hurt me. And so, Dr. Black, in the chapter you co-authored in the book titled Racism, Science, and Tools for Public Health Professionals, the definition given for cultural competency means behaving and communicating effectively and appropriately in cross-cultural situations in pursuit of individual and organizational goals. Would you explain how a person's culture, and further elaborate on how this can impact their health outcomes?
Okay, yeah. So culture can impact one's health outcomes in numerous ways. And first, you must know that there's actually these surface level things that we often associate with culture, which are language, food, music, holidays. And we associate it with culture because those are the things we actually see. However, there are also these factors about culture that we don't see, which we call deep culture. And this includes how certain cultures have different rules for communication, or have different notions for courtesy or manners, or have different approaches to decision making and problem solving. So these differences can very much influence a patient's interactions with their provider, particularly in the U.S., when accepted ways of being are mostly in alignment with Western European culture, and that is white culture in the U.S. So if one's cultural ways of being are not known, or they're not respected, such as ensuring that a mother-in-law is always in the room for a woman patient, or that you don't look a person in the eyes out of respect. And also you're mentioning, like, if someone doesn't really trust or believe in the same belief systems or faith systems or faith that others do, and don't respect what that means for that person in their care, that you definitely can see this, that could be cause for mistrust in this patient-provider relationship. And some patients might not seek care at their local facilities because they don't feel comfortable. And this can ultimately lead to delays in diagnosis and treatment.
Dr. Black, in an article you co-authored about an intersectional analysis of racism and social determinants of health in Brazil, I found it interesting, and it was so compared to the United States, where in 2010, white women living in Brazil, sixth largest metropolitan area, had a median monthly income of roughly $1,500, while black women had a median monthly salary of $865. In the study, you noted one of the participants in the study, a black health professional, remarked on the difference between white and black women, noted, for white women, it is easier when it comes to jobs, employability, is higher for white women, and white women don't need to worry about the racial issues. In relating to the middle class white and black women, both will be hired for the same job, but the white ones will find more possibilities to improve and get better wages, while the black women will always be challenged about their competency to be in charge, and white women are naturally accepted by society. Another participant in this study, a black health manager, referred to this inherent privilege that white women have as symbolic capital that this white woman represents because she is accepted everywhere. She has what is considered good appearance and other things. As we look at the injustice in salaries, promotions, unequal and fair treatment in employment, even the lack of black physicians and nurses, what impact or role has this white privilege, and we use that term loosely, played in health disparities?
Yeah, so one thing is that white skin and heritage give white people an advantage at receiving the best or better care or resources than their people of color counterparts. And this is even occurring when white people suffer from other inequities, such as income disparities. So, for instance, black women with a professional or terminal degree have worse birth outcomes than white women with a high school education or less. And this actually has been seen over and over again in different studies for different outcomes. So whiteness is like a fast pass to privilege that has nothing to do with that individual's education, their abilities, their job title, or anything else we actually connect with privilege. And furthermore, all the systems in the U.S. have been structured to benefit white communities and keep white privilege and wealth intact. So when a system is built around you succeeding, of course you succeed. And if a system is built so you can fail, of course you have to work harder to navigate that system, or you will inevitably fail. And this is the reality for white people and black and indigenous people of color in this country, and why we see a lot of the health disparities that exist is that we're favoring some groups over others and providing them with advantage to navigate these systems more fluidly and easily than others.
Wow, that reminded me, my daughter-in-law, one time someone said something to her about white privilege, and she thought, I've never thought about white privilege. I don't really consider myself having white privilege. So she did a little experiment at the time to see if that were true. And I don't want to go into the details about what she actually did, but she did go into a public place and just tested this theory out. And she came home to my son, her husband, and was just shocked at the fact that it is actually true. And the more that we are all aware of that, then the more opportunity we will have to correct this path and to make this world a place where everyone is welcomed. Dr. Black, this has been such an eye-opening, revealing experience to sit and talk to you. I really want to do it again, I hope you'll be receptive to that, because you have so much information that is so beneficial for everyone to hear. So I want to thank you, Dr. White. Do you have any closing comments or statements that you would like to make?
Oh, man. One thing I would say is that everyone has a stake in this fight towards social justice and racial equity, and that we all have our kind of place or role to play. And so one thing is just figuring out what your role is and doing the best you can in that role. Because with everyone, if more people are invested in this as like not just a hobby or something we do when an injustice occurs that's in our faces, but that we do this on a daily basis, that we can actually make more movement towards kind of addressing a lot of the inequities we see. So just find your place, find your role, and act.
Great. Thank you. Also, if our listening audience would like to learn more about Dr. Black's work, there is a book available that I believe, Dr. Black, you helped co-write, or
yes, I was a lead author
on
the chapter.
Okay, great. All right, and the name of the book is "Racism, Science, and Tools for Public Health Professionals." Is that correct?
Yes.
And is that available on Amazon? Is it easy to get that way?
You can purchase the book on Amazon, or also you can go to the American Public Health Association Press, which is APHA Press, and they are actually the publisher of the book, and you can access it that way as well.
Great. Well, thank you. Catherine, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ms. Dykes, and thank you, Dr. Black, for being with us today. Your brilliant mind and explanation and has really, again, enlightened our listeners, and we're so delighted to have you. And my final thoughts are pretty much in line with what you said. Some values or morals must be universal, like human rights and the equal worth of every human being. When mankind acknowledges the value in every human life, we all win, no matter what it is. So thank you, Dr. Black. Thank you, D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, for having me as a co-author. I am elated to be here and elated to be a part of this series that uncovers and unfolds and peel back the layers of injustice and racism and doing our part to make a difference.
Yes.
It's been such a pleasure being in your presence. So thank you both for inviting me to be here today.
Well, thank you. This has been a production of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason seminars and educational programming. Additional funding is provided by Wendland Cook Foundation. For home study materials designed to broaden one's awareness, please visit our website at www.faithandreason.org.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children. Evermore.